Robin Hood Radio and the Robin Hood Radio Network is proud to present Leonard Lopate at Large, lively hour-long in-depth discussions providing overviews and context to topics usually covered in partial measures. His guests include leading thinkers, scientists, artists, economists, farmers, historians, authors, and politicians. Mr. Lopate is a Peabody Award winner whose numerous honors include 3 Associated Press Awards and 3 James Beard Awards.
Welcome to Leonard Lopate at Large. I'm Leonard Lopate. Alfred H. Moses, who served as the U.S. ambassador to Romania during the Clinton administration, has written a memoir called Bucharest Diaries, Romania's Journey from Darkness to Light. In it, he recounts his long association with Romania and includes firsthand accounts of the diplomacy, both public and private, that helped that country recover from 4 decades of rigid communist rule. He is a Washington attorney and chair of UN Watch, who previously served as a special counsel to President Jimmy Carter and special presidential envoy for the Cyprus conflict. He was also national president of the American Jewish Committee. In 2002, Romanian President Ion Iliescu awarded him Romania's Marc Cruce Medal, the only American to have been so honored. His book is published by the Brookings Institute, and I'm very pleased it has brought Alfred Moses to our show now. Welcome. I'm sorry if I messed up the former Romanian president's name.
All Romanian names are difficult to pronounce. The main thing to remember is they all end in U.
So how should I pronounce it?
Ion Iliescu.
Oh, Ion. So that's an I-O-N. Okay. When and why did you first go to Romania?
That's an interesting story. I didn't expect to go. None of my ancestors ever set foot in Romania. I had no ties to Romania. I was in Jerusalem, and I was part of the National Board of the American Jewish Committee, and there were 3 delegations leaving Israel, one going to Madrid, one going to Bonn, which was then the capital of the Federal Republic of West Germany, and one was going to Bucharest, and Bucharest just sounded a lot more interesting. I knew very little about the country. It was behind the Iron Curtain. So I persuaded my wife that the two of us would go, and off we went, flying from Israel to Greece, got on a Romanian airline flight. Tarom was the name of the airline. We're taxiing down the runway in Athens. My wife looked up and saw chewing gum on the inside of the cabin and turned to me and said, "I'm getting off. The whole plane is held together with chewing gum." Well, that wasn't exactly true. We landed, and that started the story.
And what was the purpose of the trip?
The purpose was to look in on the Jewish community in Romania. Before the war, there had been 800,000 Jews in Romania. After the war, there were only 400,000 left. 200,000 were killed by Romanians in Transnistria, that's just east of Bessarabia, now part of Moldova, and 200,000 were killed by Eichmann and his cohorts at Auschwitz. Of the 400,000 that remained after the war, most of them went to Israel as soon as they could. By the time I got there, this is 1976, there were still some 50,000 Jews in Romania, and they were in very bad shape. They've been thrown out of government jobs. They were living on charitable contributions from American Jewish organizations. It was a very pitiable situation. There was one rabbi left. There had been 400 rabbis before the war. So I went there on a humanitarian mission to look into the Jewish community and see what I and others like me could do to help.
Haven't the various governments denied any complicity in the Holocaust?
Well, the Romanian government has admitted some responsibility on behalf of the Romanian people, but Romanians look upon themselves as victims, not as perpetrators. So they see themselves as being oppressed by whomever, the Hungarians, the Russians, the Turks, the Germans. They don't accept responsibility for the slaughter of Jews, even by Romanians, unfortunately. The German government has accepted responsibility. The French government has accepted responsibility for shipping French Jews off to concentration camps and to certain death. Other countries have been somewhat more reluctant to do so. The Romanian government, I think, has gone part of the way, but hasn't gone the whole way.
The cover photo on your book shows a very impressive building. And wasn't Bucharest once called the Paris of the East?
Ah, you're wonderful. Yes, it was. I think that was put together by some Bucharest public relations.
What was your impression?
It was a very shabby, down-at-the-heel remnant of the City of Light on the Seine. Bucharest saw its glory days in the 20s and early 30s when it was exporting oil. There was some prosperity. There were homes built that were quite elegant. And the city was laid out not on the model of Paris, but a model of a modern city. Even had its own Arc de Triomphe, which was erected after the end of World War I. The only difference was it was made out of plywood, not out of stone. It was later recovered with stone. Romania was trying to catch up to it in the 20s and 30s. It has a unique history. Its language is a Romance language, according to Romanian historiographers. Romania derives its language, much of its culture, from ancient Rome.
Because it was a possession of ancient Rome?
Yes, Dacia, which is a big part of Romania. It's Wallachia, Moldova, the two historic principalities, and this big slice of Transylvania was called Dacia. And there were Roman legions there. I have walked over the Roman ruins along the Black Sea. It is historically accurate. And Romanian culture, at least the language part of it, does have Latin roots. If you can speak Italian, you can probably get by in Romania.
Really?
Go ahead.
No, I didn't realize you'd get by speaking Italian. Did know that Romanians often cite their certain similarities with the French.
Well, the French, yes and no. Romania is a Francophone country, and France sees it as a natural ally. The Romanians aren't quite as well disposed. High culture in Romania before World War II was French. If you were an educated Romanian, you spoke French. Then the Russians came in and wanted people to speak French, which they refused to do. Partly speak Russian, which they refused to do. Today, the second language in Romanian is English. And how do they learn English? The kids watch television. And it's remarkable how fluent they are in English.
You write that there's no other country in the world with a sadder history than Romania. There's some pretty sad histories around the world.
Well, yeah, that was probably an exaggeration by me, but it may well be true. That's true in Europe. In Europe, there's a pecking order that runs from west to east. The English have their doubts about the French. The French aren't always fond of the Germans. The Germans don't look to the Poles for inspiration or leadership. And almost everybody looks down on the Balkans. Romania is the largest country in the Balkans. Former German Chancellor Bismarck is reported to have said that the Balkans are not worth the bones of a single Pomeranian grenadier. That's the attitude of most Europeans towards the Balkans in general, and Romania in particular.
Are they concerned that our current president has confused the Balkans with the Baltics?
Well, I don't think one can underestimate our current president's lack of knowledge of the world as it exists. So whatever he may say doesn't startle people as sort of expected. I don't say that with any disrespect, but President Trump knows very little about the world we live in.
So what was the economy like when you arrived? This is when Ceausescu was still in power.
When Ceausescu was, yes, in 76, it was dreadful. Everything was owned by the government. All private dwellings had been private dwellings had been taken over by the government. All apartments were owned by the government. If there were shoeshine stands in Bucharest and never saw any, they would have been owned by the government. It was 100% government ownership.
And you saw office workers shoveling snow. What did your guide tell you about those office workers?
Oh, he said they were volunteers who were doing their patriotic duty for the Socialist Republic of Romania. These poor devils have been dragooned out of their offices They were out there shoveling snow in February 1976. It was a miserable sight.
And then coming down the elevator of the Athenae Palace Hotel on your first day in Romania, you saw old women scrubbing the floor.
The Athenae Palace had a glorious romantic history. It had been written up in novels about espionage and romance and this and that. My wife, Carol, and I stayed at the Athenae Palace. The next morning, went down the elevator, as you just said, opened the iron great doors, and there were women on their hands and knees, as you said, older women, scrubbing the badly scarred, once-tiled floors. My wife turned to me and said, "Alfred, we're never coming back here." Never is a strong word. 18 years later, I was the American ambassador to Romania.
And did she come back with you?
She did and didn't.
She spent a lot of time here because she got ill, didn't she? And
she was receiving
medical treatment in the United States.
That is correct. She didn't go with me when I first went over. My daughter did, oldest daughter. Carol, my lovely wife who died in 2004 after 48 years of marriage, came over three times. She was never comfortable being away from her doctors at NIH in Washington, but yes, she did come. She braved it. She was immensely proud that I was the ambassador. I didn't remind her, and she didn't mention that 18 years before she had said, "We're never coming back here."
You mentioned that you met with the chief rabbi, Moses Rosen. What was his status in the government?
He wasn't in the government. He was a member of parliament because he headed the Jewish community. In every community, they called him cults, not religions. Had a seat in parliament. So he was one of some 14 cult leaders had a seat in parliament, but he was not in government. He was the chief rabbi of Romania. The fact is, he was the only rabbi in Romania. But when he was elected chief rabbi in 1948, there were some 400 rabbis. He was a historic figure. I've often told people, if he hadn't been a rabbi, and perhaps if he hadn't been Jewish, been born in the United States and gone to Harvard Business School, he might have been the CEO of General Motors or IBM. He was enormously wily, very brave in his own way. He made his own agreement with the devil, Ceausescu, a Faustian bargain, which was in effect that the Jews in Romania won't be the dissidents, they won't be on the streets protesting as they were in the former Soviet Union. But in return, you leave the Jewish community to me and its spiritual leaders, and we'll be faithful Jews, faithful to our tradition. We won't be involved in politics. And he made that work, and that was much to his credit.
But you say that the Jews and other religions were all called cults. So were there any functioning synagogues and Jewish schools and other signs of religion?
Well, that was the deal. The synagogues functioned. There weren't that many Jews to attend them, but Chief Rabbi Rosen had a way of getting his parishioners to show up. The Romanian Orthodox Church continued to function. It was badly infiltrated and compromised by the communist authorities all the way to the top. The head of the church, Theocrist, had been compromised. Compromise meant that they told the authorities that they knew of persons who were less than fully loyal to communist Romania. It was a very insidious culture. Almost 5 million Romanians were members of the Communist Party out of a country of 23 million, a very high proportion of the population. And the communism in Romania was imposed from the top down, starting with Soviet bayonets. And the Soviet army occupied Romania in 1944 and was tightly controlled initially by the Soviet Union and then by communist leaders such as Ceausescu.
But Ceausescu was kind of split from the Soviet Union for the same reasons that Tito split in Yugoslavia?
Very keen observation. Yes and no. Tito split in 48. Ceausescu split after 70. earlier, his predecessor, Georgescu Dej, had taken an independent position from the Soviet Union on some issues. But that was a game, too. Georgescu Dej and Ceausescu figured out that if they made nice with the West, they could get things in return in the way of trade and recognition. But they didn't split in terms of internal ideology. They did not always follow, this is Georgescu Dej and Ceausescu, diktats from Moscow, for example, during the Six-Day War between Israel and its Arab neighbors. The communist world severed diplomatic relations with Israel. Romania did not. Ceausescu condemned Brezhnev's occupation of Prague in the spring of 1968, put tanks on the runways of the airports in Romania so the Soviet Union could not bring in airborne troops. In those respects, he was independent. Internally, he ran a Stalinist regime, enormously oppressive, a lot of people in jail, no freedom of press, religion, speech, you name it.
So it's all of the... So all of the Khrushchev, the changes that Khrushchev and others had enacted in the Soviet Union that loosened things up a bit, didn't happen in Romania.
Absolutely not. You're exactly right. There was no Khrushchev recognition of Stalin's errors. Stalin's statute was still up in Romania when I went there. There was no perestroika after Gorbachev came in. There was no goulash communism such as you had under Kadar in Hungary. It was an extremely oppressive communist regime, probably second only to Kim Il-sung in North Korea.
And it bears certain similarities. My guest is Alfred H. Moses, who's written a memoir of his time as ambassador to Romania called Bucharest Diary. But right now we're talking about the years before. The first time you went there, you had an important chance encounter in the streets of Bucharest when you were approached by these three Jewish teenagers.
Yeah. They came up to me in front of the Athenae Palace Hotel, and they asked me if I was an American. And I proudly said, yes. And then they said, are you Jewish? And I proudly said, yes. And then it all flowed out. They said, you've got to help us. We're blamed for everything that goes wrong in Romania. Please do whatever you can to allow us to leave Romania and emigrate. So that became my mission for the next 13 years, arm wrestling with Ceausescu and his thugs. And I did manage to get many Jews out of Romania. They went to Israel. I got Christian clergymen are in jail, out of jail. I got the Baptist Bible, Cornelius translation of the Bible in Romanian into Romania. Each of those was a story. Each was a struggle with Ceausescu.
But the Roma, the gypsies, also have been a persecuted minority in Romania.
Always. And still today, they're disadvantaged throughout Europe. That's a separate story, but it's an important story. I reached out to the Roma when I was ambassador. And that's a historic problem that Europe has not been able to solve. The Roma historically are thought to come from somewhere in India. Their culture is quite different, very rich, very musical, talented people. But they have not assimilated, and they're in the lower rungs economically in Romania and elsewhere in Europe, in Italy. In Spain, you've got
France.
A good deal of illegal activity, smuggling. Call it what you will. It's a very difficult problem, and Europe has not been able to come to grips with it and solve it. Has there been progress? Yes, but not nearly enough.
You write that as a result of the encounter with those teenage boys, you, quote, built a cottage industry in the U.S. with the goal of getting the dwindling Jewish community out of Romania. Now, who were your allies, and wasn't Israel already secretly funding immigration from Romania to Israel?
Yeah, I did not know that at the time. Shame on me. Yeah, they were, and Germany was paying Ceausescu to get ethnic Germans out of Romania. I think they were paying $10,000 a head. The Israelis were paying $2,000. I didn't know that, and I didn't need that. We were able to get the Jews out. I wanted to go to Israel with the enormous help and encouragement of our government here, the administration, President Carter, President Reagan, President Bush, Herbert Walker Bush, the State Department, the Congress. We had tremendous support in the Senate on both sides of the aisle. It was truly a bipartisan effort. Senator Stevenson on the Democratic side took the lead. Senator Danforth on the Republican side. Wonderful stories. And what we had was most favored nation tariff status, MFN, which came up for annual renewal. It made very clear to Romania, if it didn't allow its Jews to emigrate, it wasn't going to get MFN status. That was very important to Romania, because without favorable tariff status, it couldn't export to the United States. And it was exporting close to $1 billion a year of goods. So we were able to use the leverage through the Congress, the administration, the State Department, and other Jewish organizations. I was a leader of the American Jewish Committee, but other Jewish organizations helped. The Conference of Presidents of major American Jewish organizations, the Joint Health Joint Distribution Committee, B'nai B'rith, ADL. We had wall-to-wall support in the Jewish community, and we had a good deal of support across the country. This is a humanitarian issue, and Americans are enormously forthcoming and generous when it comes to trying to help people in distress around the world.
You've described Romanian life under Ceausescu as totally oppressed, and yet the United States government wasn't completely unfriendly simply because of this policy. Was it kind of like a way of sticking a thumb in the eye of the Soviet Union?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I thought we were awfully foolish about it, but Ceausescu was hosted at state dinners in the White House by Nixon, Ford, and Carter. Sit down, please. He was knighted in Westminster Abbey by Queen Elizabeth with his piggish wife, seated next to him, Elena. He played it pretty well. The Brits made him a knight. We hosted him at state dinners, all because we thought he would follow an independent road on major foreign policy issues. And to some extent, he did. But he knew what he was doing. He was playing both sides of the aisle.
Why was he interested in trade? As far as most Americans are aware of Romania, Romania either is a place where that gave us pastrami or Dracula.
Hey, you hit on both of them. Pastrami started in Romania, and Dracula did too. Dracula was the creation of a British author who never set foot in Romania. There was no Dracula. There was Vlad the Impaler. He was about 4'8" or 9" or 10 or 11. I don't know. He's less than 5 feet. And he impaled his enemies. And from that historic account arose Dracula. Pastrami is pressed dried beef. Started in Romania, came to New York, and now you can go most places in the country and order a pastrami sandwich. Romania, like most countries, particularly in those days, was looking for hard currency, meaning non-communist currency, which didn't trade on markets. And to earn foreign currency, hard dollars, whether it be British pounds, French francs, German marks, or U.S. dollars, you had to export and get paid in those currencies. So it was vitally important for Romania to be able to export to the United States.
What were they exporting?
A variety of things. Furs, a bit of oil, some metal goods. Romania has gold mines. Romania has some bauxite to make aluminum. It's quite advanced in manufacture of clothing. The Boss suit, which people think is made in Germany, is BOSS. Is made in Romania.
Hugo Boss.
Hugo Boss, right. Carpets, the Romanian carpets, they're made with vegetable dye, and put them in the sun for more than a few hours. They may fade, but they look good when you buy them in the store. So you put it all together. It was important for Romania to export to the United States. then the tyrant Ceausescu decided he was going to eliminate his entire external debt, which was $13 billion. So he sold everything he could in Romania that could be sold. By the time he was executed, which was on Christmas Day, 1989, Romania had eliminated its entire external debt.
And who had he sold everything to?
Anybody who could buy it.
So he was really bringing capitalism into Romania without calling it capitalism?
No, sir. He was selling state-owned enterprises and sticking the money in the government coffers. No, it wasn't capitalism.
But the companies buying it were capitalist companies, weren't they?
Yeah, that is true. You got a very good point. There were American investors and British and German in Romania, and those industries were owned by foreign interests. But it was less ownership of the businesses than buying equipment. For example, the Romanian oil industry used a lot of universal product equipment, which was purchased from American companies. But the American companies didn't have any ownership interest in those oil fields or in those refineries. So it was more buying foreign equipment than it was actually buying ownership interests. Ceausescu had completely eliminated private ownership of industry as well as private residences in Romania.
One of the striking things I learned from your book is the way in which a private citizen can get involved in affecting government foreign policy. Were you surprised? Were you surprised by your success?
I was amazed. I attributed it to an outrageous effort on my part. And people were quite receptive. I would go to the State Department and go all the way up to the secretary, and we'd talk about these issues. Zbigniew Brzezinski, who was President Carter's national security advisor, briefed me when President Carter met with Ceausescu. We went over the script in advance, and he called me the next day to give me a readout. People were enormously open. It isn't that way today. I'm not just simply referring to the Trump administration. It hasn't been that way in Washington for the last 10 or 15, 20 years. But 40 years ago, and that's what we're talking about now, things were quite open. And occasionally I would walk over to the White House and go in and see, not the president, of course, but members of his staff, National Security Advisor staff. People were very open and were eager to reach out to people like me who they knew had a deep interest in these issues. I was very much involved in Israeli issues. I was actually asked by the State Department to write the first draft of the Camp David Accords. It was a pitiful effort on my part, but I did it. Things were quite different in those days.
As you were building what you called your cottage industry, did you ever imagine that one day you might be an ambassador?
No, I did not. What happened was a close friend of mine worked for me, became my friend after he worked for me in the White House when I was special counsel to President Carter. He had been lent to me by the State Department. He was an up-and-coming, then quite young Foreign Service officer, brilliant, Mark Grossman. By the time my ambassadorship became even an idea in someone's mind, Mark was the executive secretary of the department. We had lunch one day, and he said, "Al, you always been interested in Romania. What do you think about being the ambassador?" I said, "Mark, it's a great idea. I'm not a Foreign Service officer. I didn't give a nickel to President Clinton's campaign. Let's talk about something serious." And he said, in effect, "Well, think about it, Al. You know a lot about Romania. Get your friends whom you know in Washington to put in a word or two for you." Well, what I didn't know was that Mark had arranged within the State Department that I be the State Department's nominee to be ambassador and would send the name over to the White House. I didn't know that, but I called President Carter, and he agreed to help me. And other people I knew, Lane Kirkland, who says the AFL-CIO, was a good friend. And I walked into his office, said, "Lane, someone suggested I be ambassador of Romania. What do you think?" He says, "It's the best thing ever happened to those bastards," referring to the White House. He was been battling the White House over NF, was it we had the agreement with Mexico and Canada, NAFTA, North America Free Trade Treaty. And as head of the unions, he wasn't in favor of NAFTA. But he pitched in for me. Rahm Emanuel was on President Clinton's staff, became mayor of Chicago. I had met, and we became friends, and he helped me. Another gentleman I knew who had been a client of mine down in Arkansas, president of a bank, had been chairman of the board of trustees of the University of Arkansas. When a young Bill Clinton went down to teach law there right after he graduated from Yale Law School, his name was Lou Ramsey, called the president and said, Moses would probably be a pretty good choice. And they had some friends on the Hill. Senator Lieberman weighed in for me, Senator Danforth. And then Senator Simon from Illinois, I never met, wrote a letter to the president. It was a great letter. His chief of staff had been in the State Department and knew of my interest in Romania. So he drafted the letter for Senator Simon and said, Dear Mr. President, I have been to Bucharest, and if Al Moses wants to go there as ambassador, send him.
Maybe he didn't think he was doing you a real favor.
Probably not.
We're talking about Romania on Leonard Lopate at Large today. We're back with Alfred H. Moses, who has written a memoir of his time in Romania called Bucharest Diary, Romania's Journey from Darkness to Light. It's published by Brookings Institute. You write that unlike elsewhere in Eastern Europe, Romanian Jewry hadn't produced great scholars, writers, and even Jewish lay leaders. There's a really important Romanian-born Jewish writer who lives in America now, Norman Manya, but he felt he was forced to leave. Why do you think there wasn't more intellectual activity in Romania as there was in so many of the other Eastern European countries?
That's a hard question to answer. The great yeshiva tradition, which existed in Poland, Lithuania, parts of the Ukraine, even in Hungary, never took hold in Romania. I can only think of one or two prominent American Jews who traced their ancestry back to Romania. A lot of Romanian cantors. There's a musical tradition very strong.
The Kusevitskis, among others.
Yeah, but Imani is Jewish, but he's not. He's Jewish by origin. He's not Jewish in his outlook on the world. He was not educated Jewishly. When you think of the great Jewish scholars who were born in Europe and came to this country, I can't think of any single exception who was Romanian. It was a backwater, unfortunately, and the Jews elsewhere in Europe sort of looked down on the Romanian Jews. Leadership did not come from the Romanian Jewish community, at least leadership in the sense of Jewish scholarship. It's a historical fact. The explanation is beyond my competence, my knowledge base, but I think it's a fact.
But Norman Manya has told me that he was made aware of the fact that being Jewish made him into somebody who was considered a danger to the society. But he also, told me that at a certain point Ceausescu abolished the office of the censors. And that's when things really got dangerous, because as long as there were censors, you knew what lines you couldn't cross. And once that was eliminated, it was dangerous for anybody. And you couldn't say anything about the wife of Ceausescu either.
Oh, Elena, yes, she was something. Norman Manya was a very gifted writer. I urge people listening in to go on Amazon or wherever you get your books. Bookstore, you can get a Manya book. He's a very gifted writer. But he's not writing in the Jewish genre. He's writing more in the Romanian genre. What he said is true. Things were very dangerous in Romania. It was a good place to get out of, not a good place to remain. But there's a part of the story here that we probably should discuss, because the Jewish aspects are just a part of it. It was the prelude. During the 3 years I was ambassador, we tried, when I say we, the American government, to bring Romania from the bottom of the heap, where it had a tradition of over 40 years of communism and fascism before that, into the democratic order, so it would become part of the structure of Europe and be fully integrated within the European community.
Well, it became a member of the EU and NATO.
But member of the EU and NATO. NATO was what Romanians wanted more than anything else. But to show how far Romania has come, it will next year have the presidency of the EU. And that was simply unthinkable 25 years ago. It's a full member of NATO. We have some 5,000 American servicemen in Romania manning a missile shield on the western shore of the Black Sea. We have a very strong military structure and arrangement with Romania. We have something we created when I was ambassador called a strategic partnership that has taken hold, and the two militaries are in very close cooperation. Again, that was something that hadn't existed before I was able to come over as ambassador. NATO was the chant. It was the holy grail for Romanians. They desperately wanted to be part of NATO, and for understandable reasons. Historically, Romania had been occupied by Hungarian troops, German troops, Russian troops, Turkish troops. Romania was the view that if it was part of NATO, it would have the nuclear umbrella, the nuclear shield provided by the United States. And from the moment I arrived as ambassador until the day I left, it was the NATO chant wherever I went. Just to illustrate the point, a few months before I left, I was in Bukovina, northern Romania, just a few miles from the Ukrainian border, visiting what were called the painted churches. These are churches that still have the original paint, the original pigments. There were frescoes on the outside of the churches. They're simply beautiful. And people from all over the world go to Bukovina in Romania to see the painted churches. I went. I visited with my sister. We stayed in a monastery overnight. The Father Superior was a wonderful gentleman who hosted us for dinner and then the following morning for breakfast. And as I was leaving, we embraced arm in arm. He looked me in the eye, kissed me on both cheeks, and offered a prayer in the name of Christ and NATO. Well, it was sort of mixing things up. I think Jesus said, render unto Caesar what is Caesar's, unto God what is God. Well, for the Father Superior, it was NATO and Christ all in one breath. It wasn't just the Father Superior. Wherever I went, I heard the NATO chant.
But in order for Romania to join NATO, the country had to sign a treaty with Hungary.
Yes.
And NATO, Hungary, that was a problem.
It wasn't. I'm glad you raised it. We negotiated that treaty. It was outrageous. I negotiated with Hungarians and with Romanians and brought about a reconciliation. There were some differences with regard to ethnic rights within Romania. For the benefit of Hungarian nationalists, we were able to solve that problem by recognizing the rights of Hungarians to exercise cultural autonomy, but individually, not collectively, and not territorial autonomy. Did the same thing with Ukraine. I went to Kiev and negotiated with the government in Kiev up to the very top, Secretary of State, Minister of State, to bring about a treaty between Ukraine, a basic treaty, Ukraine and Romania, both of which were needed in order for Romania to get into NATO. One of the principles was laid down by our then Secretary of Defense, William Perry, was that countries coming into NATO would have no border disputes with their neighbors. So we were able to solve that both between Romania and Ukraine, Romania and Hungary. That was a mammoth undertaking. And looking back upon it, it was outrageous on my part that I would negotiate with the Hungarians. I was the American ambassador negotiating with the Ukrainians. But we got it done. And the administration, President Clinton, Secretary Albright, supported me in that. They didn't have to. They certainly didn't owe me anything, but I think they understood what I was trying to do, and they were wonderfully supportive.
Now, what did Romania have to do to become a member of the EU? Did it have to privatize its industry?
Well, yeah, and we had largely accomplished that. Even today, about 11% of Romania's national product is in state-owned enterprises and regime automates, these RAs, these big utility colossi. But it had privatized a large percentage of its industry, 70-80%. For NATO, it had to modernize its army, cut it down from 150,000 military people to 75, and have largely a volunteer army, heavily staffed by non-commissioned officers instead of heavy brass. In communist countries, traditionally, there are a lot of majors, colonels, generals, a lot of brass. That's top-heavy, but you wonder if people can do the actual work the military is required to do. We helped Romania to reform its military. We were able to help it obtain Western equipment. General Shalikashvili, who was chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, came and visited in Romania with me. General George Jalin, who was Supreme Allied Commander of Europe, came several times to Romania. We had two military missions permanently in Romania. We worked around the clock with the Romanian military to downsize and modernize its military. And that has succeeded. When I arrived in Romania, the only planes it had were some old mysterious French plane that eventually acquired some electronics from the Israelis, Elbit. Today, Romania has F-16s. It's been transformational. We started that process. We didn't see it to its conclusion, to where it is today. But on the military side, Romania today has a competent military. On the economic side, last year it had the fastest growing economy in Europe.
Did oligarchs wind up in control of many of the industries as they had in Russia?
That's a great issue. I'll get to that, but let me just finish on the point I was about to make, and I hope our listeners are sitting down. In 2017, last year, the per capita income of residents of Bucharest was higher than it was for the residents of Berlin. That's simply astounding. As for the oligarchs, no. The oligarchs are a Russian phenomenon created primarily under Yeltsin, who turned over the riches, the jewels of the Soviet Union to bidders, I suppose, cronies, call them what you will, people who had the inside track. That didn't take place to the same extent in Romania. For one thing, Romania didn't have the same set of jewels. But insiders did take advantage of the relationships. There were people who had been in the SRI, which was the Romanian internal security apparatus, counterpart to the KGB and Soviet Union. And those people got a jump start when Romania started privatizing. And they did pick up businesses at ridiculously low prices, but they didn't have the enormous value that the oligarchs obtained in the former Soviet Union. I mean, whatever the number of those people is, whether it's a dozen, two dozen, 50, they're billionaires. I don't think there are any billionaires in Romania.
Now, Ceausescu was succeeded by Ion Iliescu.
Correct.
Wasn't he regarded by some people in Romania and foreign governments as well as a Ceausescu protege?
He was never Ceausescu's protege. He was suspect. He had been, from birth, a communist. His father was a communist. He had gone to communist school in Moscow. He was a loyal member of the communist apparatus. Was actually a minister of sports, I think, and therefore a junior member of the Politburo. But he split with Ceausescu in 72 when Ceausescu came back from visiting Pyongyang and decided he was going to be another Kim Il-sung. He thought that was wrong, and he became a dissident and was surly demoted. Time of the revolution in 1989, he was the manager of a rather unimportant printing plant in Bucharest and was known to be a dissident. He quickly assumed the position of head of government, almost by acclamation among his cronies who were part former communists who had split with Ceausescu. They went to Ceausescu in a circle, some military figures, a few intellectuals. He was elected by acclamation been elected in elections in May of 1990, a few months after the revolution, overwhelmingly because I think the Romanians saw him as the savior from communism and Ceausescu. That was probably in May of 1990. Then he was reelected in 92 in an open and fair election, lost in 96 to a center-right candidate, Emil Constantinescu. And then in year 2000, he was reelected, or elected for a third term. And the State Department sent me over to confer with him after his election to talk to him a bit about our views and how he intended to govern. Iliescu was okay. He's now 88 years old. He's not in good health. He's passed into history. I saw him as Romanian a couple of years ago. But in a sense, he's the father of post-communist Romania. He had become a believer in democracy, a believer in private enterprise. He still had hang-ups about rich people. He didn't like to see rich people. He's always led a modest life and has not sought riches for himself. And I think all Romanians, those who think well of him and those who don't, will agree he's never been corrupt. He's honest. He's lived a modest life with his wife, who's a researcher. Iliescu was okay, and he did a great service for Romania, in my view. But the center-right, Christian Democratic believers and thinkers never accepted Iliescu. They always saw him as a crypto-communist. I think that's unfair, but so be it.
Has there been a resurgence of neo-Nazi sentiment in Romania, as we've seen in Hungary and Poland?
Not exactly. I don't know that Hungary is neo-Nazi. Viktor Orban is certainly center-right. Orban and the government in Poland, both of which are far-right, I think are more influenced by Putin. To be frank, I think Putin has got them by the tail. And the fight today is between U.S. influence, Western Europe, and Putin's efforts to destabilize Europe. And he's made the greatest inroads in Poland and Hungary. I wouldn't call it
and Washington
even Nazi. Nazism is not popular in Eastern Europe. There are more neo-Nazis in Germany, maybe can say this, maybe in Charlottesville, Virginia, than there are in Romania.
Now, you mentioned that just about 5 years to the month, Ceausescu and his wife, Elena, were executed in 1989 on Christmas Day.
Correct.
What were they charged with? I mean, executing is not the same thing as just toppling.
Well, it was a sham trial. They could have been legitimately tried and convicted on dozens of counts. But the army had picked up Ceausescu. He flew away from communist headquarters, I think it was the 21st or 22nd of December, when there were protesters out in the square in front of where he was speaking. Some shots were fired, and he was whisked away in a helicopter with his wife and security guard. The helicopter nadir'd about 100 miles north of Bucharest and then had to land. He was picked up by the army. They stuck him and his wife in a tank, and on orders of the provisional government, National Front government, he was tried. It certainly wasn't a fair trial. He was just berated with accusations. And then he and Elena were shot. It was the only violent end to communism in Eastern Europe. Mm-hmm. No other communist government, was toppled by force. Not in the Soviet Union, and not in the former satellite countries. Rather amazing. It was not a bloody end to communism anywhere except in Romania.
Now, we're almost out of time, but I'm curious about a couple of other things. You really had no training as a diplomat, so what kind of training did you receive before you assumed the position of ambassador?
I can answer that very quickly. None. I went through procedures, not substance. I like to study. I knew a little bit about Romanian history. I spent a good deal of time traveling the world. I was then the national president of the American Jewish Committee, and I had met with the likes of Anwar Sadat, the president of Egypt, and Menachem Begin, prime minister of Israel, Helmut Kohl, the chancellor of Germany. I felt very comfortable talking to heads of state. I worked for a head of state, President Carter. I was comfortable in my own skin. I really landed, sniffed the air, looked at my Foreign Service staff, who were all wonderful, true experts, kissed them on the cheeks and said, okay, let's go. And I did what I thought needed to be done to help Romania move towards the West and strengthen the bilateral relationship between the two countries. I was a fairly self-confident lawyer. I didn't need the job, but I loved the job.
Now
and I just went at it.
Go ahead.
No, that's really it.
You were awarded, as I mentioned earlier, is it the Mark Cruse Medal? Or the
Cruse Medal, yeah. That was very kind. He conferred on me by President Ilescu when he was in Washington.
What is that medal honor?
Good question. I don't have the declaration in front of me, but as those things go, it probably says a lot of things that aren't entirely true. It probably credits me with saving half of the Western world, which is a bit of an overstatement, but those things are always over the top. It was for building the bilateral relationship and helping Romania move. These weren't the words in the salutation, but I think it's fair to say to move from darkness to light.
Now, you mentioned the second elected president after the fall of Ceausescu, Emil Constantinescu.
Emil Constantinescu, that's a tough one.
And why was he less successful than Ilescu?
Oh, I don't know. They were very different. Emil had been the rector of Bucharest University. He took on sort of hero status when Ilescu brought some thugs into Bucharest, coal miners, some beat-up students who were protesting on the streets. Constantinescu opened the doors of the university so they could escape. And he was lionized for that by a man named Kaposo, who was the titular head of the former Peasants' Party, Christian Democratic Party. Kaposo himself was in poor health, and he knighted Emil to be the Christian Democratic Party's candidate for president, and he succeeded the second time. He lost badly the first time to Ilescu in 92, but won in 96. He wasn't a politician. He was a very fine man. Did some good things. Was a good caretaker president, but did not run for election. He's bowed out of politics entirely.
And what brought you back to the country after, three and a half years?
Brought me back
to the U.S. Why weren't you ambassador to Romania longer, considering all the things that you had done?
That's about it. Well, also, I resigned. My wife was not well, and I just felt my first call was to be here with her. And I'd done all I thought I could do in Romania.
You're now the chair of UN Watch. What does that work entail?
Well, that's in Geneva. We promote human rights around the world. With some success, we sponsor the annual Human Rights Summit in Geneva, where we have close to 1,000 people gathering. We champion the people that the Human Rights Council in Geneva, the UN Human Rights Council, largely ignores. We have a lot of oppressive countries in this world, and they have victims, whether they be in Cuba, Iran, Afghanistan, Mozambique, Iraq, elsewhere. We speak out for him. One poor devil, Baladi, is in jail in Saudi Arabia. I'm trying to get him out of jail. I've been unsuccessful. The world is a very tough place for people who don't hew the line, the government line. And there are a lot of oppressive governments. So UN Watch's job is to speak for those people who don't otherwise have their champions. It also speaks out on behalf of Israel, United Nations in Geneva, where there are more resolutions condemning Israel than there are resolutions condemning all of the countries in the world. So it's twofold, to give Israel a fair shake, but more broadly support universal human rights. And that's a calling of mine.
Thank you so much for being on our show. Alfred H. Moses has written a memoir called Bucharest Diaries, Romania's Journey from Darkness to Light, published by the Brookings Institute with lots of photographs done by your son, right?
No, he actually, that's my son-in-law. Oh. He's a world-famed photographer, and I sent him all the Kodak prints I had, and he made them all look pretty glossy and nice. And Leonard, thank you. It's been an honor to appear with you, and I wish you every success. And to the listening audience, God bless you all.
And that brings us to the end of today's show. My great thanks to Ambassador Alfred Moses, to Susie Stultz, who produced today's segment, to Reggie Johnson, who was at the audio controls, to Charlie Morrow, who composed our theme music, and to my producer, Jesse Lent, who helps make things run smoothly. Leonard Lopate at Large comes to you on Saturdays at 4 and Tuesdays at noon. You can subscribe to Leonard Lopate at Large podcast on iTunes and by clicking on Robin Hood Radio's archive program site, which is robinhoodradio.com. You can also check out Leonard Lopate at Large Facebook page. We hope to see you next week.